breaking news this morning, the United Kingdom and the EU have agreed to a new divorce deal in a key Brexit breakthrough.
The concern of the FAA is not just that it potentially was misled during the certification process for the 737 MAX. The other concern is that documents that are being turned over from Boeing to investigators on Capitol Hill, they've been known about for several months, and they're just now being turned in.
Well, you started to see a bifurcation in the high yield space. So the lower credits and high yield have underperformed drastically over the last couple months. They're probably actually interesting places to put money to work at some point in time.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team.
The U.S. and China are knee-deep in a trade war. The U.K. on the verge of a historic vote. Congress is weighing impeachment, and the markets still rise. Hello and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. I'm Chris Prytower, and on this edition of the News Hour, we interview guest expert Mark Chandler, who discusses a U.S. economic slowdown and says that surplus savings is in the wrong hands. He also believes the rally in the dollar is about over. Also, we interview technician Craig Johnson, who explains why tech stocks are going to have a tough time. And he reveals a pick for investors looking for a longer-term timeline. As always, Ryan Poplav is here to tell us what moved the markets this week. And on the big picture, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplav discuss the current economic slowdown, how investors are the most bearishly positioned since 2008, and how there are signs for an uptick in global growth and what this means for investors. All that and more on this edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. Well, Ryan, the earnings season has kicked off this week with several big name companies announcing what appears to be good results so far. But how do you think the earnings season is playing into the market rally this week?
Well, Chris, it definitely influenced things on Tuesday the most from what I saw and gave things just a great start. But before we go there, let's back up and talk about how the earnings season has set up for this quarter. The past two quarters, things have been down. Earnings are estimated to decline 4.6% for this quarter, the third quarter. For the S&P 500 earnings. So far, 83 companies have warned of lower guidance, while only 30 have issued positive guidance, according to FactSet. Now, a decline of 4.6% is more than what I think we'll see. You look at the past couple of quarters where there was a big estimation of where things were going to be, you know, based on either economics or warnings heading in like we're seeing right now. And as earnings were reported above expectations, the earnings growth estimate was able to rally. So the first quarter, that finished down 0.2%, and the second quarter finished down 0.05%. So the earnings story this year has definitely been more scare than what is actually really there. However, what we have now that's different from then is a backdrop of weakening economic figures, but we also have an accommodative Fed. That's totally different this time than over previous quarters. So monetary policy accommodation and the hope of better trade relations with China are the two biggest drivers, I think, behind where the high PE multiple is now on the S&P 500 than I think really economic results, as long as it's viewed that the U.S. has the best situation for investment versus other financial markets, and as long as the U.S. consumer stays strong. And you know, there's one more thing right now, since we were talking about the Fed earlier and accommodation, the Fed funds futures are at 89% probability for a rate cut this month, which I think is on the 29th and the 30th. 30th is when they'll announce. And on Friday, we had Clarita and Esther George, who she said that she doesn't think it's necessary. She's been a hawk all year long. And then Clarita says every meeting essentially is a possibility to review. So, and he said no set course. So we have an accommodative Fed, and there's a pretty high probability right now that there's going to be a rate cut. But let me address your question now, Chris. JP Morgan Chase, United Health, and Johnson & Johnson kicked things off Tuesday with better than expected earnings results, and their stock prices were rewarded, and so was the market. You know, you could feel this sigh of relief over concerns of a possible third quarter of negative earnings results. You know, that kind of lifted for the most part with the broad equity indices moving up on Tuesday. I think there were only a couple of areas that were weak. I think in the more risk-off areas like real estate and consumer staples and utilities. I think we would have seen the very same reaction play out on Wednesday too, as you know, we're looking at Bank of America, United Airlines, and J.B. Hunt Transport Services were up on their earnings, but the reaction was mitigated with the rest of the market by poor showing of the retail sales report. It was down 0.3% month over month, so decent decline there. And we saw a decent cut in the dollar as a result of those results. And likewise, the following day, Thursday, industrial production was down 0.4% for September, and the dollar again went down. So that's a concern. And I guess on Thursday, the Philadelphia Fed survey was down. I think it decelerated, not necessarily contracted, but decelerated for October. So now we're starting to look at some of the economic numbers for October. So economic results were no help to stocks. And to finish the week, the leading economic indicator released on Friday was down 0.1%, and the second quarter consecutive negative reading. And China's Q3 GDP, that was also announced on Friday. They grew 6% year over year, the slowest since 1992, Chris.
Well, you mentioned China, and I wanted to ask, where do we stand on trade, on tariffs? There's a lot of headlines. We see this whole thing going back and forth. We heard the NBA involved in the controversy relating to Hong Kong. Where do we stand on trade?
Well, on Monday, there was a Bloomberg report that Chinese officials were not willing to sign the deal. And they were essentially saying, we want to discuss this a little more. But Trump and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin reassured us that there's a date set now to sign. It was kind of ephemeral when on last Friday, we've got an agreement, phase one, but there was no set signage. So they just reassured everyone that, hey, we have a date. It's going to be, I think, at the economic discussion in Chile. So that's going to take place in November. The other item Wednesday was the approval of legislation in the House of Representatives that proved support to pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. I didn't get to look at the details of that, but it just seemed to that was another trade headline that concerned the markets because the Chinese threatened countermeasures should it pass in the Senate. And we have a handshake on phase one, essentially, of the trade agreement, but nothing on paper. So it's logical for the market investors to still be kind of hesitant. Hey, is this still going to get through? Any one of them can pull back from this agreement because, again, nothing's on paper. Finally, late in the week, let's take a look. U.S. imposed tariffs of $7.5 billion on EU goods. So shifting away from China, now looking at what's going on with the EU, that's kind of concerning. That's going to definitely affect U.S. consumer goods, wine, and a few others. Essentially, when you look at these kind of headlines, that does concern things. And this was as a result of the EU essentially creating subsidies for Airbus, which the World Trade Organization found illegal earlier this month. So it's possible we could still see the EU retaliate off of these tariffs. But, let's talk about a few more micro news items, which had, I think, major effects on their industries, but not necessarily completely reverberating on the market, except for, something we did see on Friday between Boeing and Johnson & Johnson. We'll talk about that in a second. But the Brexit deal between the UK and the EU voted on or will be voted on this weekend. Here we are recording on Friday. But just the fact that there was an agreement, that really helped to rally the euro and the pound. And traders, I'm sure, there are on the edge of their seats as we wait to see what happens here this weekend. If voted on, it could definitely lead to a catalyst for value investors maybe to jump into Europe. I was just watching CNBC for a little bit, and there was a couple of REAs or investment firms that are talking about beginning to overweight Europe now due to this possible catalyst here. So definitely something that could be changing things and the kind of the flow of investments there. Thursday, three drug companies negotiated an $18 billion opioid settlement. So we saw a big rally in some of those healthcare names that were part of that. I think Teva and a few others saw a sizable rally. And then Friday, some scandalous news. Like I said, Boeing regarding some instant messages that suggest the company misled the FAA on the 737 MAX. And in addition, Johnson & Johnson recalled baby powder after tests revealed some traces of asbestos. So those two, remember, Dow 30 is price weighted. Boeing is a large component of that. And Johnson, I don't know specifically what theirs was, but we saw the Dow down 200 points on Friday as a result, I think, mainly from that. Not so much China's GDP or the LEIs, but mainly those two stories. So again, trade headlines, you asked, definitely is a market mover. And the market continues to be at their mercy of those headlines. And it should be interesting to see how this Brexit agreement vote goes on Saturday and how that plays into the currency markets and the equity markets over there.
Well, it will be interesting to see where this heads with Brexit, given all of the previous turmoil, but also in the coming days to see what happens with the Fed and with earnings. So, Ryan, thank you for stopping by the studio. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
This week, we had a very interesting interview with Adam Rosenzweig. He's the managing partner at Gehring and Rosenzweig. We discussed how commodities as a whole are at the cheapest levels relative to financial assets in 100 years. He also discusses the various sectors in the commodity space that he thinks has the greatest value. And also, we touched upon their analysis and research using AI machine learning, Google's TensorFlow, Amazon Web Services, essentially Amazon's supercomputers, and the analysis they did on the U.S. shale space and some interesting insights that they uncovered from doing this, and what this means for the oil sector, oil prices in particular. So a lot of interesting information from Adam. Here's a clip of a portion of that interview.
It's been a very good time to be a commodity investor. And so the three moments that really jumped out at you would be 1929, 1969, and 1999. And in 1929, obviously right on the cusp of the Great Depression, you know, owning primarily it was gold at the time, but owning gold and gold-related mining stocks was a fantastic way to try to insulate yourself through the worst parts of the Great Depression. 1969, obviously, we were right on the verge of the inflationary period of the 1970s that really, again, you know, you didn't have the same wipeout in nominal terms in the stock market, but from a real perspective, the stock market lost quite a bit of value through the 1970s. And had you chosen to invest in commodity and commodity-related equities, you know, you would have done extremely well. And again, in 1999, it flashed that same signal when commodities became radically undervalued compared with stocks. That was a great time to be a commodity investor as well. So, you know, obviously every cycle is a little bit different, but in the past, it has always paid to look at what this ratio has been telling you.
So if you want to hear this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click where it says subscribe.
Global economies are slowing down. Central banks are starting another easing cycle, and interest rates are heading lower. Do you know how lower interest rates will impact your income if you're retired or about to retire? Make sure you're prepared. Work with Financial Sense Wealth Management to help you develop a plan that provides you with predictable income no matter what happens in the markets. Don't take chances with your future. Let us show you how to avoid falling interest rates and loss of income. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. Let's work together to create a better path to your financial future. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
This week, I'd like to introduce one of our longtime standing and frequent guest technicians of the show, Craig Johnson, a certified market technician and a certified financial analyst. He's got two of those big boys, currently a managing director and chief market technician analyst directing Piper Jaffray's technical research group, a man otherwise known as Bullseye Craig, a name Jim fondly has given. Craig, welcome to the show again.
Thank you for having me back. Appreciate it.
We appreciate you. And Craig, let's start off with, I think, the biggest item on the list here that I'd like to review with you, your September 25th edition of the Informed Investor Research. You published this issue with a revision to your year-end price target of the S&P 500 from 27.25 to 31.25. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What caused you to revise that? And what are your views on U.S. stocks?
The reason we changed this here in our September publication is simplistically this. We're starting to see some of the indicators that we've long looked at are starting to improve. Our 40-week technique has started to broaden out a little bit, which is a good sign that we're getting more participation in the marketplace. We're starting to see some of our MACE indicators, which had been at very, very low levels, starting to improve. So we're seeing some early signs that the breadth of this market is picking up, number one. Number two, I think it's becoming clear with $17 trillion of negative yielding debt in the world that this money is going to have to start shifting out of fixed income and start coming over into the equity markets. And again, this is a message I have. It's been repeated to me many times on my most recent European marketing trip I just took 2 weeks ago, is that every single month The fixed income managers at these various pension funds are basically taking the money and handing it off to the equity part of their funds. And I think that's a trend that's going to continue for a while. So I think you've got a structural shift happening in this market, taking money from fixed income to equities, and that's going to last for a while. Those are two of the reasons why we made that change. And then I would just say the third is there's so much pessimism out in the marketplace at this point in time that it's very difficult to see a market really sell off when it's as pessimistic as it is when you look at some of the AAII numbers right now.
I agree with that. And I was going to ask you on the flow data. I've seen that, and Jim talks about this as well, there's a lot of flows going into bond funds. Have you seen that inflecting yet, or is that still the case? It's at such a point that you think it can't get any worse. It's got to flip over into equities or somewhere else.
Well, I think there's been this kind of this bullet trade, you know, in some of the fixed income markets at this point in time, where people are seeing the appreciation as rates have been going down and people have been trying to trade that to a degree. You're seeing that segment playing out, but you're also seeing a lot of the pension fund managers, they're investing for their constituents and that money's got to shift over. And so I think you're seeing that this kind of trend that I'm talking about, structural trend shifts in the market, sort of it's happening below the surface. And as you wrap it all up, I don't think it's being quite captured as accurately as what it probably needs to be, but there's a pretty steady flow, especially the folks in Europe, more so than even the United States, because in the States, we still have positive yields on our markets.
In this report that you did, Craig, one of the titles was that you said with this revision up to 3125 for the S&P to proceed with caution, given that I think indecision looms over market leadership is what you said. While the biggest part, I think, was your price upgrade, what are some of your concerns here that warrant the caution? We are climbing this wall of worry. We've seen quite a few economic indicators here the past couple of weeks that have been contracting. And, you know, since looking at this report, it's been a few weeks. You know, this was September 25th when you issued it. Are you seeing the leadership unfold yet?
Let me answer that question this way. So part of that title, what you led into, it really comes together for me this way. This title was coming together from the fact that I think about this market right now like that flashing red light as you're coming down a dark road late at night and you got a flashing red light. It means come to a complete and full stop. It means look left. It means look right. And it means ultimately to proceed through the intersection with caution. And right now for us, I think that is how we need to be thinking about this market. Because at the sector level, we are starting to see some inflection points in some of these industrial companies. And a lot of people haven't looked at these industrial companies in a while. But overall, as I wrap it up through all of the industry work we do, I'm starting to see that relative strength picking up in that space. I'm also seeing a little bit of a pickup in the transportation sector too. Take that and then offset it though with the FANG stocks. And today we've got stocks like Netflix, which have come out and put up decent earnings. And the stock has sort of kind of hit the high water mark earlier in the day. And it's been kind of fading throughout the day. But the FANG stocks, there's a gigantic amount of market cap tied up in all these FANG stocks. And FANG with a double A, might I add. But the FANG stocks as a group are not breaking out the new highs. Whereas I'm looking at other groups now like the industrials, and they're starting to pick up in relative performance. I'm seeing some improvement happening in the financial sector. Some of the large cap financials, JP Morgan is a pretty interesting looking chart. And I'm seeing improvement in stocks like Goldman and Bank of America and some of these others. I have always said on this show that we need to have the financial sector at least participating, not necessarily leading, but at least participating. And it is doing that right now. So for all these reasons, I think we've got a little bit of a rotation going on toward some of these early cyclical areas. And from my perspective, I think this is probably something that's going to last for a while. But let me be clear. I don't think this means that it's happy days are here again, and it's time to come out with some sort of new major call on the market. I think this is kind of a, again, proceed with caution. Bump up our year-end objective from 27.25 to 31.25 and sort of kind of tactically pick your spots at this point in time, because there still are a lot of concerns and a lot of challenges that continue to overhang this market that we need to very much pay attention to.
I completely follow. Proceed with caution. Have some tight risk management if you're going into these areas and tracking them? You know, like you're saying, some event could happen. We're seeing tweets move the market. We could see an economic number move the market like it did over the past 2 weeks with the ISM numbers and retail numbers yesterday. And you've mentioned industrials. Are you seeing this group as a kind of a value play, bullishly inflecting possibly leadership? If I was a value investor, what's the setup right now technically that you look at the most that's favorable, that someone sitting maybe in some cash would feel maybe comfortable investing in versus maybe less cautious and more, this is a long-term play here?
Sure. So let's do this. It's a great question. Let me zoom back out and say this first. As I think about value versus growth, taking a very simple ratio chart of looking at the Russell 3000 growth and the Russell 3000 value, creating a ratio chart, dividing one out against another. Growth has been winning for a very long time. And there's been a few periods where value has taken over and then growth has kind of reasserted itself. And we just had a kind of a big watershed trade just a couple months ago here in this growth versus value trade. I'm still of the mindset that we're going to see value work for a while here. And as value works for a while, I think it's going to be tough on the FANG stocks. I think it's going to be tough on some of the tech stocks in general. And we're starting to see some of these SaaS for software names under meaningful pressure over the last several weeks. Now, taking your question and coming down into the industrials here, what are we seeing specifically that we like? Well, we're starting to notice that some of the groups that are related to housing are starting to work. And we're seeing groups such as the aerospace names starting to show inflection points. Things like Boeing are standing out to us. As we go through and look at some of these housing related stocks, I'd point out things like Masco, Builders FirstSource, a couple of names that have been kind of hitting our radar as of late. And then also some of the names in the farm equipment space are starting to show inflection points on both a absolute price and also on a relative basis at this point in time. So again, I'm finding that this is broader, not just one specific area inside of industrials, but aerospace, the housing related and building related, and even some of these farm equipment areas are standing out to us.
Since we're here, I wanted to ask you, if we're looking at the strength in these areas, one area that we have been tracking for some time has been semiconductors, tracking Micron's earnings since March of last year or April, hearing them talk about a bottoming developing. Last time they had earnings, they said the same thing, that they think the bottom is in, but they're still waiting to see a improvement in pricing. We're seeing semiconductors really outperform. If you take all these areas, so we're talking pro-cyclicals, right? Industrials, housing stocks, semiconductors. And recently, we've seen shipping really perform well. Dry bulk, as well as energy shipping, do extremely well because of a report a couple of weeks ago we talked about on the podcast. If you look at these areas, they're very cyclically oriented. How do you pair what you're seeing in these areas with some of the other areas, like, let's see, small cap, you know, as another risk-on style of an area? Like you're saying, we're seeing some areas that are doing really well, but maybe not all risk-on areas. What's your feeling right now on cap? With small cap has been languishing in relative performance, do you see a change in the coming?
If we're going to see the FANG stocks, which have been a huge amount of market cap, not able to break out the new highs, I think some of those stocks are going to be sold. And if we just sell small parts of those names, that's a lot of money coming down into small mid-cap land. And I think that will eventually lift and push up some of these stocks. I think there's a lot of value opportunity down in some of these small mid-cap names that have been sort of ignored. They're not really per se on the radar of some of the, you know, the ETFs out there at this point in time. And I think there are some specific opportunities that we should be thinking about in small cap land. And again, when I come back and I think about a simplistic ratio chart of, say, maybe the S&P 500 divided by the Russell 2000, again, there's been kind of an inflection point starting to unfold there in that ratio chart too. So again, I kind of think you're going to get this interesting rotation here in Q4 that's probably going to persist and last longer than people recognize. But that's going to be the opposite of really what we had seen in the kind of first and second and part of the third quarter of this year, which was it was all kind of risk on and it was all sort of large cap names that were driving the performance. I think you're going to see some profit taking in there and you're going to see some money come down into these small cap names. And I think that, again, is going to be surprising to people and it's going to catch some people off a little bit off guard because that has not been the playbook thus far for this year. And then in terms of the semiconductor names, again, I like a lot of these names inside of the semiconductor space. NVIDIA, Intel, Texas Instruments, Broadcom, Qualcomm. These are some of the largest names in the Philadelphia SOX Index. And those charts and setups look pretty darn good. So that's going to be kind of a trade, I think, that will continue to work inside of tech.
Yeah, I appreciate your thoughts on that. And, you know, we've talked about a couple of these ratios already, Craig. You've talked about growth versus value. You've talked about the S&P versus small cap, as I just asked you about small cap. What about discretionary, consumer discretionary stocks versus consumer staples, which seem to have done really well based off of the falling yields this year? We've seen a bit of a backup in yields recently. What are your thoughts here? Is there a possible inflection here as well?
You know, you hit a perfect bullseye, you know, right there with that question. And that is the crux of what every single investor is dealing with at this point in time. It's coming back to the growth versus value and how do you structure your portfolio with basically little income that can be achieved on the fixed income side, given rates where they're at. And again, the $17 trillion negative yielding debt around the world, investors are kind of taking their portfolios and kind of splitting it into two buckets. You've got your growth side of the portfolio and you've got your income side of the portfolio. And every month when these bonds sort of roll off, they're shifting their money, they're putting it over into higher yielding stocks and dividend oriented portfolio. Do I think that we're going to get a rotation from, say, those cyclicals over to more of the defensive or vice versa? I don't know if you're really going to get that to happen. I think what you got are really two types of investors that are out there. I think you're going to see more of the growth investors focusing on the cyclical names because clearly there's still a lot of good looking, interesting looking consumer stocks out there. Nike stands out, looks good. But then also on the flip side of this, on your staple side of it, you know, we'd look at stocks like Zoetis. And again, great stocks, interesting dividend yields on this. And then you come back and you look at Campbell's and you look at some of these other names. Again, good steady dividends, good shape, charts are still trending well. I think you're not really going to have an either or from those two particular sectors, but I think it's going to be more balanced between the two because there's such different needs among investors at this point in time between growth versus income.
That makes a lot of sense.
And then let me add one other thing. I think the way you trade this is you take a simple indicator such as like the VIX, put a 200-day moving average on it. And this is, again, more of a tactical perspective. And then whenever you start to see the VIX break below its 200-day moving average, that's kind of a risk-on trade. Some of that money kind of starts to shift over toward that growth side of your portfolio. And then when you see that VIX start to break above that 200-day moving average, which is more of a risk-off, you take a slice of that portfolio and you shift it more over toward the dividend and income-paying part of the portfolio. So you can be tactical and still keep your feet on both sides of this kind of very difficult market to be trading with all the uncertainty out there. I think that can be a winning strategy for investors.
Craig, let's shift over. We've talked quite a bit on the equity side of things and slightly on bonds and interest rates a little bit. Let's take a look at the dollar. I mean, you know, we had retail sales yesterday come out contracting, and that had some direct interaction with the dollar. We saw the dollar break through the 50-day moving average. What do you see here in the dollar? And then you know, the implications are, you know, what does this do for an investor now if the dollar is breaking down? From a larger perspective here, do we start shifting more of our assets into foreign equities, or do we also shift more into commodities? What are your thoughts here?
First and foremost, if the dollar is going to weaken, I would say President Trump will be excited about having a bit of a weaker dollar, number one.
Yeah, I think so too.
but from a trend perspective, yes, we just 3 days ago broke below the 50-day moving average. We are seeing some weakness when you look at some of the shorter-term momentum indicators. But you are starting to get some of those indicators getting oversold. So the big support coming up right now is going to be the 200-day moving average at about 97, call it 97.38 at this point. I suspect you're going to get a relief rally off of that 200-day moving average. The longer-term trend is still up for now. But if we were to break below the 200-day moving average, which is a level that we pretty successfully have defended since the beginning of this year, and we really haven't been below that 200-day moving average since early 2018, I would say you are correct. Some of your international stocks would probably catch a bid if we were to start to see some weakness in the overall U.S. dollar. I would also think that perhaps some of these multinationals can do okay in that kind of environment, because the opposite trade, which people have historically talked about, is when the dollar strengthens too fast, it hurts the big multinational companies because they have such a large part of their business outside of the U.S. But for me, I think the trend is still up for now. Yes, it sold off, but the trend is still higher. I think you need more time and evidence to say that the dollar is going to break down. You got a lot of support also at about 95 on the trade weighted dollar index too.
So yeah, short-term weakness, but still long-term picture still looks pretty bullish. You got to wait and see if that 200-day average gets violated.
Correct. Long-term trend is still intact.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Craig. So we've talked about maybe what that would imply with foreign investments in equities and maybe bonds. But what do you do with commodities? Looking at your research report on that September 25th edition, you talked about you're still bullish on precious metals. You would view any kind of pullback as an opportunity to add to exposure. Do you see gold dropping much lower than the most recent low was 1465? And here we are near 1500. What are your thoughts there on gold?
I think you got pretty good support that's going to come in around 1450 in gold. I still think from a longer term setup on the charts that we've got a pretty good downtrend reversal that's already been had in gold. We had this huge move since basically May of this year, where gold went from about 1282 all the way up to 1550. Not surprised to see some backing and filling and consolidating in here at this point in time, but I'd still be a buyer of this pullback in the precious metals at this point in time, because I still think that the longer-term trend is up, given this huge long-term downtrend reversal we've seen. So I'm still a fan. I'd still be a buyer on the pullbacks at this point in time.
Two other commodities. We got oil, which has been kind of languishing near support, and sort of the same story with Dr. Copper. What are your thoughts there on those two?
As I start looking and thinking about crude oil prices, first and foremost, I am surprised that given the challenges that we had seen in the Middle East with more saber rattling over there and some facilities being under attack, I'm surprised that oil prices have not been higher. But you got huge support around $50 on crude oil prices. And for me, we're toward the lower end of that range now. And as I look at some of the shorter term momentum gauges, they're starting to flatten out, like you're going to find support here and turn back higher. I want to see a move above about 55, 56. That's where your 50 and 200-day moving average is at. But I would say for now, crude oil is just sideways consolidating. And I come back and I think about what crude oil is doing, and I think about what the individual stocks are doing inside the energy sector. I mean, a lot of your listeners may not realize this, but the entire energy complex is about 4% of the entire market as we measure it. Okay. That's every stock above a 25 million market cap and a $2 price. This is the lowest exposure of energy as a sector since basically 1999, 2000. And I got to tell you, nobody likes the group and sector at all at this point in time. And in fact, the correlation between oil and these stocks is almost zero at this point. So again, I'm looking at this, and if you're a really deep value buyer, you'd be looking and sniffing around some of the energy patch names at this point in time with an expectation of a 1 to maybe 3 year hold. You'd probably be happy with what you see. But those shorter term investors thinking about momentum and looking at returns kind of on a quarter to quarter or on a 1 year basis, it might be a little bit early, but man, there's a lot of damage that's been done inside of energy at this point.
Very much. And if you look at the refiners, some of those have actually been maybe bullishly inflecting in some opinions. There's been some strength there. But I agree with you. That was back to one of my original questions to you. Is there a deep value area out there that an investor might feel comfortable with a longer term timeline? You just answered it.
It is energy. That is correct.
Hey, Craig, is there anything else that we haven't covered or I haven't asked that you really feel is important that our listeners should hear about?
I think at this point in time, what investors should also be thinking about is the healthcare sector. There's been a lot of challenges inside the healthcare sector. And this has been a sector that's been disappointing for people. But there's been some big winners in some stocks out there in the managed care space that I think investors need to come back and start to rethink some of these positions. In our most recent informed investor publication that we had put out, I was pointing out that not only the managed care group, but also some of the HMOs, they're at the very upper end of a price channel that's been intact going all the way back to the late 1990s, and they're starting to roll over and fade. So while it's important to figure out what to buy, it's also important to figure out where we should be taking some profits and trimming some positions. And I think these HMOs and also these managed care groups are probably going to have some headwind at least until this time next year, until we get closer to the election here in the States. But these are groups that, while they might be great companies, they don't look like they're great stocks at this point in time. And I would be trimming some of those names. Stocks like Anthem and stocks like United Healthcare and some of those would be names that I'd be trimming some positions on for your listeners.
The sage words right there. Good companies, maybe not good stocks. So I appreciate that. Craig, if someone wanted to get a hold of your research, that's all we've been talking about here is access to some of the publications that you've done. What can an investor do to obtain some of that research?
Yeah, I'd recommend reaching out to the Piper Jaffray sales folks, either in sales trading or in sales, and we can certainly get you signed up for the work that we put out. You know, if you like charts and you like technical analysis, I'd also strongly encourage all the listeners to take a look at the CMT Association's website. It's a great program. As you know, I've been involved with the association for over a decade now and been president and vice president over the years. There's a lot of good things happening there. And I would just point your listeners to take a look at that if they're interested in technical analysis. There's a lot to be learned.
The curriculum and everything is phenomenal. And you don't have to do it just because you want to go into this industry. You can do it because this is your passion. This is why you're listening to Craig Johnson on the show. So, Craig, thank you so much for showing again on this week, this podcast. Appreciate your contribution every time we have you.
Glad you had me back on.
Thanks, Craig, and take care.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
This month, this October, November, might be one of the few times that the upcoming weather events will have more of an impact on your food and energy commodities than the trade war and whatever Trump or the leader of China, whatever one of them says in a press conference or tweets at 3 a.m. What we're anticipating is with these colder temperatures, look for prices to go up because we have low yields, higher risk of crop damage, and then, of course, we also have the lower trade availability right now.
Joining us on the show today is Mark Chandler, Managing Partner and Chief Market Strategist at Bannockburn Global Forex. And Mark, you and I are speaking on Wednesday the 16th. Retail sales figures for September just came out and fell for the first time in 7 months. Does this raise concern in your mind that the current weakness we see in the U.S. manufacturing sector is spreading to the U.S. consumer?
Thanks. I think that one number is probably a bit early to reach that conclusion, especially because the thing that drives consumption, and I think consumption is very important. It drives 70% of the economy. So what drives consumption is wealth, so that's housing prices, equity prices, and income. That's jobs and salaries. And so I think the material basis for consumption remains robust. But of course, job growth is slowing. But with this retail sales number, a couple of things that strike me. What we're really interested in is consumption. But we got retail sales. Retail sales is only about 40% of consumption. And if we, now that we know what retail sales is, will it help us predict what personal consumption expenditures, which is going to be reported towards the end of the month, will it help us predict what that number is? Not so much. The correlation is only about a third, a little bit more than a third. And partly that is because retail sales doesn't adjust for prices. So the fact that gasoline prices fell 0.7% in September is picked up as a decline in retail sales. And so even though consumers might have purchased the same amount and gasoline prices fell. So I think it's a bit early to jump to any conclusion about the U.S. consumer, but I think that you're right. That is the key to focus on when we're thinking about the trajectory of the U.S. economy.
Okay, so I think that's a good point. Retail sales are only about 40% of consumption. We need to be looking at personal consumption expenditures, and that comes out at the end of this month, probably right before or around the time that the Fed is going to be meeting. Let's talk about your macro outlook first. What is your take on the U.S. economy at present? As I noted in the beginning, we do see, I think it's the second month of contraction in the U.S. manufacturing sector. Basically, all eyes are now on the U.S. consumer. And the more important part of the economy, we should say the larger contribution to GDP, is on the services side, U.S. manufacturing accounting for a much smaller portion. So there's a lot of eyes and strategists paying attention, say, hey, are we going to see a pullback in spending? Are we going to see the U.S. consumer falter? Do you see that taking place? Do you think that we are going to see the services get dragged down and see a wider or broader slowdown in the U.S. economy this year or in 2020?
Yeah, Chris, so I think that the economy, you know, we've got the longest expansion on record. And part of the reason it's been able to be so long, so old, is because it's been so slow. I see several indicators pointing to late cycle activity. I use a 12-month moving average of non-farm payrolls. That peaked a few years ago. Same thing with auto sales. 12-month moving average of auto sales, to get rid of some of that monthly fluctuation, some of the noise, kind of hone in on a signal. Auto sales, largest durable good consumers buy, that also peaked a couple of years ago. And I see that this, even though the U.S. consumer is doing well, I mean, the year over year, those core retail sales is about 4%, still pretty healthy. But increasingly, it seems to me that consumption is being done with credit. We've seen some big jumps in our consumer credit numbers, monthly numbers. So I think the U.S. economy is slowing down. And I think when the Federal Reserve Chairman Powell says things like mid-course correction, I think that implies the Federal Reserve is prepared to cut rates three times, like Greenspan did when used that phrase back in the 90s. So that would allow the Federal Reserve to cut rates in October. And like you were saying, there's about an 80% chance of that October cut price into the market. Because the economy is so old, the cycle is so old, and these late cycle developments are already taking place, I think we should anticipate further slowing next year. I think that's partly the signal that the World Bank and the IMF gave in recent days, cutting their world growth outlook, including the U.S. forecasts.
Yeah, as you just noted, the IMF saying that they now expect, they're projecting global growth to slow to the slowest pace since 2008 financial crisis. And I think that data came out yesterday on Tuesday. Do you take it that a lot of what's driving the market currently is the expectations for the Fed remaining loose, providing more stimulus, or even optimism over the trade outlook? Because that seems to be having a major influence on the stock market as well.
Yeah, so I sort of think that the stock market, rule out what's not driving it. Earnings growth does not appear to be driving the stock market. And we're in the middle of earnings season now, and we've seen a slowing of earnings growth. And I think businesses seem to be very cautious about projecting next year with their earnings outlooks. So what's keeping the stock market up? I think there's been this, it's like a going through Alice in Wonderland's looking glass. And I say that because we live in a world in which there still is something on the magnitude of $16 trillion of negative yielding bonds. U.S. rates, the U.S. 30-year bond auction, I believe it was last week, showed the lowest yield, record yield, on our 30-year bond. So so he said, well, where can we even get 2% yield right now? The S&Ps are yielding almost 2%. And when you look at the other world stock markets, the yields, even in like Germany, where they have negative interest rates, Japan, negative interest rates, you're looking at dividend yields. And so I think that we live in a world in which people can still buy bonds, not for the yield, but for capital gains. A German Bund goes from minus 40 basis points to minus 60 basis points. That's a big rally. And so I think that this juxtaposition is that people are buying bonds, not for the yield, but for the capital appreciation. And increasingly, I talk to people who are buying stocks for the dividends, for the yield, not so much for the capital gains. Because after all, when everything's said and done, of course, the U.S. stock market is pretty flat this year.
As you noted, I mean, S&P is yielding nearly 2%. It's hard to get that. If you look abroad, we have negatively yielding debt of $16 trillion. So that is something that appears to be growing. And there are some even concerns that we could see negative yields here in the U.S. Do you think that that is a possibility at this point?
Yeah, no, I think, let me just correct something I said before. The stock market, the S&P is up about 20%, but we really haven't gone anywhere here in the second half. So all the gains were in the first half of the year. But I hear you. I mean, I was at a conference and people are still talking about the risk of negative yields in the U.S. I think, and of course, we had Alan Greenspan a few weeks ago start that it was just a matter of time. I don't quite see it that way. I think that the countries that have negative interest rates have two things in common. One is the central bank has put the overnight interest rate below negative, below zero, and this has helped drag down the whole curve, whether it's Japan, Switzerland, the Eurozone. But the other thing that these countries that have negative interest rates have in common, a characteristic which the U.S. does not share, is a current account deficit. That is, I should say, the U.S. has a current account deficit. Every other country or bloc, like the Eurozone, that has a negative interest rates have current account surpluses. That is, they have too much savings. And instead of boosting domestic demand, they recycle their surplus savings into U.S. treasuries. And so this is driving down this, you know, their own domestic policy drives down interest rates at home, drives our interest rates lower by their demand for treasuries, and keeps us in this world of lower interest rates for longer. I have two properties. I still have floating rate mortgages on them, as I have for the last several years, because I think interest rates stay low for a long period of time. And that's what this new normal is. In some ways, I sort of feel funny like saying this, sort of like the guy who asks Mrs. Lincoln how'd she like to play anyways, is that we are still in this great moderation of relatively low growth and low inflation, which means flatter business cycles. And I think that we have to get used to this environment in which one is not getting paid anymore for passive investment. And this is what Keynes talked about when he talked about the euthanasia of the rentier, the coupon clipper. The world surplus savings is so great that it's really driving down these countries with the surplus capital, these super savers, into negative territory.
Let me pull it back to the here and now with what we saw. Again, the retail sales figures coming out weak for September. We've now seen the odds for another Fed rate cut of a quarter point jump to 90%. That's on the CMA FedWatch website. I think that's up from 32%, just odds of 32% of a cut a month ago. So that's a pretty big jump that we've seen in a month's time. And the dollar has pulled back as well. Again, you are the chief market strategist at Bannockburn Global Forex, so I know that you have your fingers on the pulse of what's going on in the Forex currency space. Is this temporary weakness, or is this something that's being driven by other currencies, expectation for further Fed rate cuts? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so you know, I'm in this camp that says that the dollar, after this 10-year-long rally in the dollar, it's about over. And it's hard, it's sort of like what they say in golf, right? You drive for show, they have these big macro views, and you putt for dough. So I think you're right. How we can make money in the market is not so much with these big macro views, but in these last few inches, if you will, and what's happening today. And so I think that the dollar is in the process of topping out. And a couple of things to keep in mind. One of the drivers I have, and I look for this pattern, where a country has tight monetary, loose fiscal policy. That's the best mix for a country's currency. That's what Reagan Volcker had. That's what, when the Berlin Wall fell, that's what Germany pursued. That's what we had last year. But now we've got the opposite. Looser monetary, tighter fiscal, that is trouble for a currency. Second thing, I find that in the last stage of a dollar rally, interest rate differentials move against it. And that's been happening not just for short run, but since last November. The German 2-year yield has been rising against the U.S. 2-year yield. That is, the premium is shrinking. Same thing with the U.K., same thing with Japan. And just recently, Canada's 2-year yield went above the U.S. 2-year yield. The U.S. is no longer the high-yield country. And I think because of our need for capital imports, because of trillion-dollar budget deficits, because of uncertainty about trade policy, foreign investors require a greater premium to hold on to U.S. rates. Hold on to U.S. assets. And so I'm looking at the dollar to gradually wind down, come off. But so far, to really solidify that, we need to see better news out of Europe and Japan. And frankly, we're not seeing that. So engine is firing now, and that's slowing down of the U.S. economy.
All right. Well, Mark, as we close, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about your work, what you do, and the best place that they can follow all of the research and analysis you provide?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. You know, I spent the last 15 years at Brown Brothers Harriman, where I was the head of currency strategy, working with some of the largest asset managers in the world. For me, I began thinking that I lost some of the effectiveness and some of my ability to impact because a lot of these fund managers, a lot of the money that we're putting, that we're giving to these fund managers is passive investment where they trace an index, or track an index. And so I wanted to have more impact than I was having talking to these largest asset managers in the world. And I joined this firm, Bannockburn Global Forex. They specialize in helping corporations, primarily small, medium-sized corporations. And this is important. We think about wholesale and retail price of money, but there's a wholesale and retail price for money. When you decide to take your family out to go to Mexico for a holiday, and you have to convert dollars into pesos, and you go to one of those places at the airport or one of those small shops, you pay a tourist fee. 3-4%. These large asset managers I've worked with are paying fractions of a penny. And so I think that helping bring this institutional capability to small and medium-sized players, I can have more impact. So I still write a daily letter for our clients. I post that letter on my blog called Mark to Market. I also, when I have the luxury of not traveling and visiting clients, and if I'm sitting in front of my computer, I'll participate on Twitter. And there my handle is at Mark Making Sense. Now, I have written two books, one that you mentioned, Political Economy of Tomorrow. And the first book, especially for people who are simply interested in foreign exchange itself, called Making Sense of the Dollar, that came out in 2009. And I anticipated this long secular rally in the dollar because so many people at the time told me it couldn't happen and blamed all these structural factors on what I think was primarily a cyclical development. So that book, Making Sense of the Dollar, published by Bloomberg, and it just and now I guess what I'm telling you is that I think that 10-year dollar rally that I called for in that book is probably over.
Well, your book, Making Sense of the Dollar, I did read that shortly after it came out in 2009, was quite an eye-opener for me, especially in terms of solidifying the thesis for a long-term dollar rally and all that went into that. So that was an amazing read. And again, just to point out, you were making the case for a dollar rally from that point on. That was definitely against consensus. A lot of people thinking the dollar was going to collapse. A lot of the thinking around that, you were making a very big contrarian call on that compared to most of our guests. And now you're saying you think the dollar has topped out. So it would pay to listen to what you're saying, I would say. And again, you can follow more of Mark's work at marktomarket.com, or you can also go to Twitter. As he said, that is Mark Making Sense, and that's with a C, M-A-R-C, Making Sense. Mark, it was a pleasure having you on our show again, and we look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Thank you, Chris. Good luck to everybody.
Find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered. No matter what direction the markets take, we can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the show today is Chris Poplava. He is the Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, so you just sent out a report this week talking about some of the different things that are going on. I know that we have a lot of different factors driving the markets, whether or not that is an expected rate cut by the Fed at the end of this month, U.S. trade talks, which are ever causing volatility in the markets. But let's start there. What is it that you're doing for clients, and how are you navigating some of these things that we have hitting the market? markets right now?
I'd say for the large part of the last year, we've been more on a defensive tilt in our accounts for clients. And the reason for that is we were looking at a peak in global growth more than a year ago. It roughly began around late 2017 to early 2018. And then we saw and predicted a peak in U.S. growth, which was kind of diverging and decoupling from the rest of the world. But we saw a peak in U.S. growth in the latter part of 2018. And for most of 2019, we've been seeing not just the global economy continuing to slow and growth coming in on the downside, but also the U.S. The U.S. has been really starting to decelerate. If you look at payroll growth, it's slowing down. Retail sales growth is slowing down. Industrial production is slowing down. So as of right now, we do have a slowdown both globally and in the U.S., which explains why we've been a little bit on the defensive side for our portfolios, meaning we have a little bit less equity than our benchmark. And on the fixed income side, we've been extending the maturities of our fixed income holdings because we've been bullish on bonds, thinking that rates would go down with the negative economic growth.
So as you noted, a lot of these changes are things that you've been doing over the last year. Tell us about some of the more recent changes that you're doing as we speak.
Well, I think, you know, one of the big kind of wild cards that was out there was the U.S.-China trade negotiations last week. And we, you know, it wasn't best case scenario. We didn't have a very comprehensive deal. But at the same time, we did delay the tariffs that we were going to apply to Chinese goods. So it has overall dialed back some of the tension there, which is really important given how much uncertainty was injected into the global markets with this massive trade war between the U.S. and China. Now, with that being said, what we've seen is that a lot of managers, with the negative growth that we've seen globally and in the U.S., plus the trade uncertainty, we've seen that investment managers and even retail investors overall have been really shifting their assets to a very defensive posture, where you can see that when you look at flows into mutual funds and ETFs, there's been very little into equities versus what we've seen in money markets and in the fixed income. And recently, B of A Merrill Lynch did a fund study looking at all the flows of that they look at. And it showed that the investors had the most bearish kind of positioning since 2008, in which they've shifted much of their assets into very defensive assets like money markets and bonds. And what I think that is setting up for is a very asymmetric outcome, in which investors have already positioned for bearish outcomes. And if we do get a bearish outcome, if trade war with China re-escalates or if trade or if economic data surprises even further to the downside, I think the reaction in the markets may be a little bit more muted than what most would expect because of how people are already positioned. Now, on the flip side, if we get positive catalysts, earnings in the U.S. come out on the positive side and surprise, if we continue to see progress with the trade war with China, and if economic growth comes in on the plus side, that I think you could see a significant increase in reaction to the market because people are positioned for the other outcome. And if we get a bullish outcome, I think you'll have a lot of people shift a lot of the money that they've put into bonds and money markets back into the equity markets. So I think this is a very asymmetric current setup right now in the markets where everyone's positioned for the bearish outcome. And if we get the bullish outcome, I think the markets could surprise on the upside.
Now, you said earlier that you've been positioning defensively, especially with a lot of the things that you were seeing with Financial Sense Wealth Management's leading economic indicator, which I know is a bit more volatile and even leads the conference board's leading economic indicator. But are you expecting to increase your exposure to the stock market or stay in this defensive mode for longer?
As I was mentioning, the global slowdown, you know, we're almost coming up on 2 years now. It was late 2017, early 2018. So in my opinion, I think we're getting to the very latter stage of the slowdown. And I think we're going to start to see stabilization internationally in economic reports and even some improvement. One of the things that we take a look at is the leading economic indicators for the OECD countries. And we're looking at the percentage of those that are falling versus those that are rising. And we're starting to see a pickup in the percentage of those that are rising, which means that we're probably nearing a trough in global growth as one by one countries begin to stabilize and begin to see their economic growth pick up. Now, with that being said, when we see global growth accelerate, I still think we're going to see a continued slowdown in the U.S. As I mentioned, our slowdown really didn't begin until the latter part of last year. And so what I'm expecting is that global growth will begin to stabilize while U.S. growth will begin to slow. And the implications of that are that the U.S. dollar is likely to weaken for the outlook over the next 6 to 9 months. And we're probably going to see international assets outperform U.S. markets, like international equities, emerging market equities over the U.S. stock market. And so what we're positioning our clients for is increased exposure into international markets, as well as cyclical areas versus non-cyclical or defensive areas of the market.
Okay, so increased exposure to international areas. And it's interesting because you're talking about how you think the U.S. dollar is likely to weaken. That was something Mark Chandler had said just prior to this, where he talked about the likelihood of the dollar topping out. And we should note that Mark Chandler was also one of the major dollar bulls in 2009 with his Making Sense of the Dollar book that he wrote back at the time, saying that he believed that the U.S. dollar was poised for a long-term bull market. Now he's calling for the reverse, saying that he thinks it's topping and it's about to weaken. And one of the things that he said, tying in what you just said, Chris, is that what we need to see to confirm that is better economic data abroad, particularly out of Europe. So from what it sounds like you're saying, Chris, is that there are some indicators that are showing we may start to see global growth pick up even as the U.S. continues to decelerate, if I got that correct.
That's correct. And part of where I'm coming from with that viewpoint was a couple years ago, I was noticing that money supply growth rates across the world, whether you're looking at China, the U.S., or Europe, we were seeing decelerating money growth, which means there was less money transacting in the economy and turning over, which would imply slower economic growth rates going forward. Fast forward to today, and we're seeing money supply growth pick up across the world, pretty much every region. And one of the indicators that I've created is a global M1 money supply index, where I'm looking at the aggregate money supply for the global economy. And that has turned up, and that usually leads economic growth by several months, which would imply that we should start to see a bottom in global growth, whether you're looking at manufacturing data or other forms of data. We should expect an improvement in stabilization going forward. And another part of that is the Chinese economy. China has been stimulating their economy with looking at credit lending, and that's suggesting that we should also see China's growth begin to stabilize, which is important given that they just published their GDP data today, which showed that they had the lowest growth rate in multiple decades. So I think China is beginning to stimulate their economy. I think they might even add further stimulus. We'll have to see. But what they've already added, we should see that begin to filter into the economy to lead to higher economic growth going into 2020.
Okay, so as you noted, this one chart, and this is the one we'll post so that all of you can take a look at it, you have the global manufacturing PMI. So that's a Purchasing Managers Index, a good pulse of what's happening in terms of the global economy, manufacturing-wise, and then you have global M1 money and Chinese credit impulse all overlaid. And so that is showing that we are likely to see an upturn in global growth in the 2020 timeframe.
That's correct. I think we're going to start to see continued improvement this year. I think the trough in global growth may already be in, and that will only be confirmed with reports that we get a little bit later to indicate that the bottom is in. And there's a lot of implications for that. As I mentioned, this is a period where risk assets tend to perform better than what they typically do in a period of slowing economic growth. And so I think cyclical stocks will begin to outperform defensive areas. And there's even further implications in the fixed income market. So we manage a balanced portfolio, so we have to not just look at the equity side of the equation, but also the fixed income side. And as mentioned previously, we purchased long-dated treasuries earlier this year as we were anticipating interest rates heading downward. And recently, we've exited our long-term treasury position because we want to reduce the maturity of our fixed income. Because I do believe that interest rates will be rising, not just in the U.S., but globally, as interest rates typically follow global growth. So if I'm predicting that global growth will pick up, I'm expecting to also see interest rates globally begin to pick up from here going into 2020. And so that's why we want to position our fixed income accounts, parts of the portfolio, a little bit more defensively.
So, Chris, if we do see an uptick in global growth in the 2020 timeframe, would that mean, in your mind, that the globe has dodged a recession and that the U.S. may be dodging a recession as well?
I definitely think that's a possibility. If you look back in 2015, we had very strong growth globally and in the U.S., and the global economy was slowing. We had a huge hit to manufacturing with the price of oil collapsing. And we saw the manufacturing sector of the economy slip into a recession briefly before reaccelerating. But back in 2016, we had the amount of interest rate hikes that Janet Yellen was going to do, then the current chairwoman of the Federal Reserve. She was projecting 4 rate hikes for the year. She ended up only doing 1, which was at the end of the year in December 2016. And we also saw a coordinated action by central banks to see a weakening in the U.S. dollar, which happened, which some dubbed the China-Shanghai Accord. So I think, you know, if you look at where we are presently, there's been a dramatic change in Fed policy. A year ago, the Fed was raising interest rates and shrinking their balance sheet. This time, they are increasing their balance sheet and they are cutting interest rates. So the Federal Reserve is what you want to watch for looking at global liquidity. And we have a dramatically different picture than where we were a year ago. And because of that, I do think there is a potential to dodge the bullet with the Fed acting aggressively compared to prior slowdowns. If you think back in the last recession, the Fed wasn't printing money until late 2008 with QE1, and they were slow to reduce interest rates late in 2007. And same thing when looking at the 2001 recession. The Fed wasn't cutting rates until a little bit before that, and they certainly weren't printing money as they are now. So I think we have a much more reactionary Fed than we have previously, which means the Fed can cushion the slowdown in the economy. But what we really need to see, and what would probably supercharge growth, not just in the U.S., but globally, is a concrete and solid resolution to the China and U.S. trade war. If we can dial that back, that will begin to dial back uncertainty, which will allow global managers and CEOs to plan their CapEx budgets a little bit more appropriately with a lot of that uncertainty removed.
Chris, one last question I want to ask you is related to the dollar. As you had mentioned that you think the U.S. dollar is likely to weaken, this was something that had just come up with an interview we did on FS Insider. And also, again, Mark Chandler, of course, saying that he thinks the dollar is going to weaken. If that were to happen, I think that this would be really good news for commodity investors, for gold investors. So if we were to see a dramatic weakening in the dollar, that's going to have a number of different implications. What are your thoughts on the trajectory of the dollar from here?
I've been predicting or thinking that we would be seeing a dollar top, and that's been something I've been keeping a very close eye on, mainly because I do believe that global growth will stabilize while the U.S. will decelerate. So this really would be a complete reversal of last year when the global economy was decelerating while the U.S. economy was accelerating. And what we saw from that was a strengthening in the dollar compared to world currencies. Now, I think we're going to see the complete opposite of that, where the global economy strengthens while the U.S. weakens. And so one of the things that I've been doing to kind of try to monitor that potential top is I compare the U.S. dollar in 30 different world currencies. And so what I look for is a uniform picture in which I'm not just seeing the dollar weaken against one currency, which can happen from time to time, but I'm looking for the dollar to weaken against most global currencies. And that's exactly what I've been seeing in the last week, 5 days, and even the last month. I'm seeing the dollar show some negative performance in the bulk of the world currencies that I track. And at the same time, I'm starting to see that gold is stabilizing near term, which would make sense if the dollar is going to be weakening, that we'd start to see gold begin to stabilize in foreign currencies and in the dollar. And so that's what I'm looking at right now, is that the trend that I'm seeing in terms of weakness in the dollar relative to world currencies near term is probably going to broaden out and extend into an intermediate term viewpoint.
Well, I want to point out that we are going to have a couple different charts that we discussed today in our interview here with Chris Baflava, Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense. Chris, what's the best way that our listeners can contact you if they have any questions about your outlook or our investment services?
They can email me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can give our office a call at 888-486-3939.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.